Well, thank you all for joining us. This is a series I've tried to do a few years ago. Chris helped me with. It's designed for professional river guides, and it's just ongoing training for professional river guides. And I talked to Chris, I think 4 years ago, we did a show about the same topic, and it was eye-opening to me. I learned a ton. A lot of people have watched it since and have learned a ton. And I asked Chris to come back because it's changing, I'm guessing. I'm sure there's like new techniques or new thoughts, and just to get an update. And it's such an important topic for us because this is a major cause of fatalities in the rivers. So I want to introduce Chris. Chris is a would you call it a professor? If you're teaching at a medical school, are you a professor?
Yeah, it's yes. Yes.
Okay, he's a professor of medicine at Wake Forest University, teaches emergency medicine, but he's also really involved. He's a boater, super involved in teaching rescue and wilderness medicine, and somebody I really like and respect, and I'm stoked to have you here. So Chris, I'm going to let you take it away and talk about drowning. And we'll do sure. Q&A at the end. Sorry, we'll do Q&A at the end.
Awesome. So real. Well, thanks for having me on, Zach. It's one of the things that I love to share is you know, knowledge about drowning, trying to bust some myths and give you guys some practical, useful information that you can use to, number one, try to prevent having a drowning on any of your trips. And secondly, what to do should it happen. So just very briefly about me, you know, I'm an emergency physician. I work in the ER. I work in the field. I work with EMS crews, search and rescue, mountain rescue. I teach a lot of swift water rescue to both, you know, private boaters, guides, and also to the National Park Service, which is one of my favorite courses I do every year. This was out last year at Lee's Ferry. We did a course out there for the National Park Service, which is super fun and great to work with all those rangers out there. But I do want to give the one disclaimer for this is going to have some depictions of some actual cases of drowning, which can be a bit graphic. I do that not to shock, not to give, you know, sensationalism, but, you know, as professional guides, you guys, if you are faced with responding to this, it's going to be gross. It's going to be dramatic. And I want you to have at least seen it before to have some idea of what you're going to be dealing with. Because time is of the essence, and you know, I want you guys to be able to respond quickly and effectively. So, you know, why does this matter? You know, every spring we have high water season. We have, you know, a number of cases of drowning, and really they make a big impact. And this year, I think everyone was aware of the really tragic case that happened in May on the Selway River right here, a double drop rapid. Where we had back-to-back drowning fatalities on the same trip within a few miles of one another. Just really just an absolutely tragic case, like unimaginable really. And wanted to just, you know, tie this all back together. You know, this does matter. This is a big deal. And one of the biggest things that we have to watch out for out there on the river. So if we look at the statistics, this is just a screenshot from the American Whitewater Accident Database, which primarily captures fatalities, but it's kind of broken down by all these different causes, both private, you know, private or commercial trips, the different causes. And if you look at all of these things, it's broken down to lots of categories, but the overwhelming majority of fatalities occur due to drowning. When you start looking at other causes, like trauma or medical causes and things, it's, you know, very small percentage. By far and away, drowning is the thing that we have to be worried about on the river. As far as, you know, a serious event or something that will cause a fatality. You know, I bring this, come back to this every time I talk about drowning, because, you know, over the years, we've had a lot of discussion about all these different scenarios, different types of drowning. You may have heard of like a dry drowning or near the person near drowning, or they had a flush drowning, or this was a active or delayed secondary drowning, all these different terminologies. In fact, up to 2002, there were 33 different definitions of drowning out there. And it's really hard to have a conversation about something or to learn how to respond to something if we can't even agree on what it is. So I want you to take all of those modifiers out of your mind and just think of drowning as just drowning, okay? It is the same process no matter what the outcome is. And in fact, that's what I really want you to focus on. The definition that the World Health Organization settled on at the World Congress on Drowning in 2006 is that this is the process of experiencing respiratory impairment from a submersion or immersion in a liquid. And the key thing to highlight here is this is a process. And the thing about processes that I want you to keep in your mind as we talk about drowning tonight is that a process is something that has a predictable outcome if it completes all the way through, right? But a process is something that can be stopped. you can reverse processes, and you can interrupt it at any different point and end up with different outcomes, right? So really think about drowning as a process. And anytime you're having any respiratory impairment after being immersed or submerged in a liquid, you are having drowning, right? And it can be severe or it can be really mild, right? We can have three different outcomes that we've agreed upon about drowning. What we want is for you to have a non-fatal drowning, so therefore you didn't die, and no morbidity, the medical term for you're okay. So you had some respiratory impairment, you didn't die, and you actually are all right now, right? What we often see, though, unfortunately, is a non-fatal drowning with morbidity. So that means that you didn't die, but you have permanent lasting health problems as a result of it. You may have ended up with brain damage. You may have ended up with problems with your lungs, right? Those are things that we are going to try to avoid. So today, we're going to give you some techniques to try to avoid that morbidity associated with the drowning, right? So we want you to live and be okay, right? And then, of course, last, you could have a fatal drowning, right? So that you drown and you die. Okay. Big picture beyond just boating, just wanted to really touch on it, that drowning is a big deal, right? So it's actually the leading cause of death of children, young children, 1 to 4 years old in the United States. Okay. It's the leading cause of accidental death among children. It's one of the leading causes of death worldwide. It's someone drowns really, 42 people drown every hour. You know, that's someone drowning every few seconds worldwide. So it's a very big deal. What we've also been kind of led astray a bit in by Hollywood about what drowning really looks like. So, Baywatch, who certainly grew up in the 90s and stuff, watched Baywatch and stuff. And this is what it looked like on Baywatch, right? So someone flailing and screaming and with their arms. But in reality, drowning is often kind of silent and quiet, particularly among children. So this was a 10-year-old that unfortunately slipped into the pool, couldn't hold his head above water, and slowly sank to the bottom of the pool. So it took more than 2 minutes to discover that he had laid on the bottom of the pool. So in reality, drowning isn't always as dramatic and flailing around and stuff as we think. Okay. So what is actually going on during the process of drowning? We just said it was a process, but what is happening in your body during this process? So it kind of all starts with the surprise. All right. So you go in the water and you kind of initially have this big surge, your fight or flight response, that you're like in survival mode, right? So you're trying to keep your head above water. You might be swimming. You're trying to swim for your life. There, if you're in a big rapid, you're trying to time your breaths going through waves. You might be getting recirculated in a hole, and you're only getting breaths occasionally, right? So you start that. You're trying to maintain your airway above water, but at a certain point, you're going to either go underwater, get repeatedly splashed in the face, or you're not wearing a life jacket. In the case of many fatal drownings and boating accidents, you will just be unable to continue swimming, and you will slip down beneath the water. Once your airway is occluded by water, whether you're either immersed, which means you're in the water and it's splashing your face, or submerged, means you're actually under the water. At that point, the big thing there is what we don't have. Since we don't have gills, we can't breathe oxygen. So we have no oxygen at that point. So once we go under, we're going to have breath holding, right? So this is involuntary. We are involuntarily holding our breath when we go underwater. And we're going to do that until the level of carbon dioxide in our blood gets so high that it's going to force us to breathe, okay? The rate that goes up depends on one big thing, and that's how much metabolic activity or how much oxygen our body is using up, right? So ironically, it's kind of the carbon dioxide level building up, which is what builds up from exercising to undergoing metabolism that makes us need to breathe. So if you're coming into that rapid hot, you're this big sustained rapid, you're paddling like crazy, you're rowing, paddling your kayak, and you go for a swim, then your heart rate's up through the roof. Your oxygen demand and usage is very high, right? So you're not going to have very long before your body's needed to breathe. On the other hand, if you're very cold, if your heart rate is very slow, if you have very low metabolic demands, you've got longer until you need to breathe, okay? But no matter what, at some point, you're going to need to breathe. Well, water is going to come into your mouth at that point. And what happens when we get water in our mouth? Well, you guys can think about last time you took a big swim or getting water in your face. We have an involuntary reflex to swallow, okay? So when water gets into our mouth, we swallow as a kind of an airway protective reflex. So we're going to start swallowing a lot of water, okay? We're probably have already swallowed a bunch of water if we're wearing a life jacket and we're getting splashed in the face, taking a big swim. You're probably swallowing water as getting splashed in your mouth all the time, right? So think about that. Our stomach's filling up with water. Well, eventually what's going to happen is we're going to take that breath and the water is going to go into our lungs, okay? And we're not going to be a whole lot, right? We don't actually end up with a tremendous amount of water in our lungs when we drown. It can be only, you know, on the order of maybe even between 30 or 40 milliliters up to, you know, maybe, you know, at max 500 milliliters or so of water in someone's lungs, but it's usually not a lot. Okay. But the biggest thing at that point though, is not really the water going into our lungs, but it's the fact that aren't getting any oxygen. So as our brain starts getting deprived of oxygen, we'll start to convulse and lose consciousness. Okay. At that point, our oxygen level is getting critically low. And after a few more minutes, the oxygen will get so low that our heart will stop. So if you think about this in terms of the oxygen level in your blood, right? So as soon as we start the process of drowning, we're at 100%. We're alive and well. We have 100% of those little red blood cells in our blood are circling around, filled up with oxygen. So the drowning process starts. And remember, that's that respiratory impairment. No matter how it's happening, whether you're being splashed or you're pinned underwater, you're just not getting oxygen and your oxygen level will start going down. When it goes down low enough, we will lose consciousness. Okay. But if we interrupt it at that point, you see, we can start coming, oxygen will come back up. Our heart still beats. Okay. We keep going down further. Say that we're still pinned underwater. We can't get any oxygen. We'll lose consciousness. Well, then the lack of oxygen will start injuring our tissue, right? So it'll start injuring the most sensitive organ in our body first, which is our brain, okay? As we keep going past that, we're going to begin to have some injury. And then beyond that, we're going to ultimately, heart is going to stop due to lack of oxygen, typically in about 10 minutes. But that can happen a whole lot faster if people that can happen a whole lot faster if someone has a huge metabolic demand, if their heart rate's really fast, if they're really exercising hard before this happens, which we see in the whitewater actually is what's happening. We hear this 10 minutes is kind of the classic thing in drowning, but we know among people that are exerting themselves really heavily, they really don't even have 10 minutes. It can be significantly happen faster than that. So classically, you know, when I give this longer version of this lecture, we kind of go into some of the history and stuff here, but throughout history, you know, and popular belief and really just common sense would make you think the problem with drowning is that your lungs are full of water. And we really focus on this as a problem of getting water out of someone's lungs and dealing with their lungs. And it's a lung problem, it's a lung problem, lung problem. I want everybody watching here to really let the lungs take a back seat and think about this as a problem with someone's brain, right? Our brain needs oxygen all the time. It doesn't do well without oxygen, even for short periods of time, like a few minutes. You know, in fact, the lungs are very important for being able to deliver oxygen to our brain, but the lungs themselves are a lot more resilient and they can get pretty darn injured and recover really well. We can see people that get, that have severe drowning, that will have very injured lungs, have a whole lot of trouble. We'll have them on the ventilator in the ICU and stuff, and their lungs will actually recover really quickly. Like within a few days, their lungs are a lot better. They're off the ventilator. They're doing a lot better. But unfortunately, if you suffer injuries to your brain, it does not recover quickly. And in fact, many cases does not recover at all. So think about drowning as a problem with saving someone's brain and focus on that. Okay. The lungs are very important though. So the process of drowning does involve an injury to our lungs that becomes pretty relevant because that's the only way we can get oxygen into someone's blood. Okay. So our alveoli here, depicted by this little cartoon, are these little air sacs that fill our lungs that have these tiny little membranes around them, all these capillaries that go around them. They're about a cell thick that allow oxygen to diffuse across and then carbon dioxide to diffuse back the other way, so that the carbon dioxide gets out and the oxygen gets in. And so if you opened all these alveoli out and laid them all out, they'd be about the size of a tennis court. So it's huge. We need all that surface area to be able to exchange the gas. Now, all those teeny little air sacs will collapse if they don't have something called surfactant in them that breaks up the surface tension. Surfactant is the same stuff that you will find in soap, right? So surfactant is what's in like Dawn dish soap. And if you see if there's, you know, oil sitting on the surface of the water and you spray some Dawn dish soap on it, it breaks up the surface tension and the oil dissipates, right? So it's the same sort of principle we need in our lungs. So if we wash that surfactant out, the little alveoli collapse. The other thing that'll happen is water gets into our lungs and if you think back to, you know, science class from high school, you know, you'd have that, that osmolality and osmolarity where you basically things will shift from an area of a highly concentrated thing to a lower concentration. Well, inside of all of your cells, you've got lots of salt and things like that. And then the water comes in from the river, and it doesn't have salt or any of those other dissolved things in it. So what happens is all that water starts rushing into all the little cells to try to make the concentrations equal, just like in a science experiment we do in high school, right? Unfortunately, what happens when that water starts rushing into the cells is they swell, and they pop, all right? So that bursts little, punches little holes all in those membranes where the blood's flowing through. And what happens when you get holes in those things is that water leaks out of your blood and into your lungs, okay? So now we've got a combination of water from the river in our lungs, mixing with surfactant, which is, we decided, was soap, which is Dawn dish soap. And then we also have teeny holes punched all in the little membrane, and it's leaking fluid out of our blood and into our lungs. So we now have basically turned on a huge faucet to make something, all right? So if you imagine that your roommate took that Dawn dish soap and they squirted it into the dishwasher and turned the dishwasher on, what do you get? You get tons of foam. And that exact same process is going on now in your patient's lungs. They've got water squirting in, they've got water from the river, and they've now got surfactant mixing with it. So you're going to have a huge amount of foam and water and stuff coming out of their mouth. And so what this may look like, this is a, the first picture of an actual drowning patient, is it may look like this. It's this pink, frothy stuff coming out of their mouth. It may be mixed with some vomit, right? So some vomit that they've come, that's been all that river water that they swallowed. And it may have some blood in it, right? Because that's some of those punched holes in those little capillaries. So it's leaking. So you may get this pink kind of blood stained froth or just foam, just looking like that. Think also this person, if they drown and they're coming out of the water, they're also probably going to be vomiting. They're going to probably vomit a lot of water. If you're giving them rescue breaths or using your bag valve mask, that also inflates the stomach with air. So that can lead to vomiting too. So you may see a lot of water coming out of their mouth, but most of it is not coming out of their lungs. If it's lots of actual water, it may be coming out of their stomach, and all that foam that's coming out of their lungs. But remember, it's not just the water, the river water. It's also water coming from in their blood. So the thing to think about here is we're super focused on the lungs here and trying to get air in and stuff. But really just be, you need to be focused on making sure that you're getting oxygen into the patient so that we can save their brain. All right. So hopefully everybody here has at least taken a CPR class before. They're great. Everyone should, it's a CPR and will absolutely save people's lives. But for most CPR classes that you'll take now, we've had a huge push for doing chest compressions only CPR. And we'll talk just a little bit about why, so that you understand why it's important, the recommendations I'm going to give you for what to do in the river. So if you're at McDonald's and you got somebody that just collapses while standing in line, they're on their third visit of the day and their fifth Big Mac of the day, and this person just collapses standing in line at McDonald's, what probably killed them? Well, probably was coronary artery disease or a heart attack, right? So they often have, you know, the most common cause of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is due to heart disease, basically. So as far as the oxygen level in most people's lung, right before they collapse, their oxygen level was fine. It was 100%. And so we have taught people to use the circulation airway breathing model there, because we can do chest compressions on people there. And we know that if we tell people just to do chest compressions, they're way more likely to do something because they don't want to do mouth to mouth on some stranger or something they see in the at McDonald's. And they can just do chest compressions. Their oxygen is still 100% in their blood when they collapse. And you got a few minutes, 5, 6, maybe even 8 minutes before their oxygen level starts dropping drastically. And by that point, EMS has probably gotten there. They've started using a bad valve mask. Maybe you've gotten an AED on them and shocked their heart out of that rhythm. Okay. So it's CAB, circulation airway breathing, because of the reason that most people are having sudden out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. However, if you're in the river and you pull someone out of the river and their heart is not beating after they gotten out of the river, the reason that probably happened is not because their heart stopped due to a heart attack, it's because they ran out of oxygen. So in these cases, we want you to do an airway breathing circulation approach, which is going to be, you know, our traditional CPR, which you would have learned years and years ago. It's still important in drowning, because the reason people are dying from drowning is because they ran out of oxygen, not because their heart went into a funny rhythm. Okay. We've got some other things to contend with too. things to think about if you're training and doing CPR with your crew, with your fellow guides and stuff. You don't usually practice doing CPR with someone with a life jacket on. So that's something to be thinking about, right? So that we can't do effective CPR with someone wearing a life jacket. A lot of our customer life jackets have buckles in the front. That's great. You can unbuckle it and start chest compressions and pull it off. Okay. But practice, you know, when you're doing CPR, we're going to show you some good videos of it here. Remember, you got to get that chest, that life jacket off before you start, start your chest compressions. This is our EMS protocol in North Carolina for drowning. And I think it breaks it down really well as just a practical, simple to follow way to approach it, right? So if someone comes out of the water, you pull them out, they're awake and alert. Their oxygen level is probably okay because their brain is working fine. If it seems like their brain's working fine, it's probably, they probably got a good enough oxygen level. Okay. But if they come out of the water and they're confused, there's a lot of things that could be going on. But the biggest thing that we want to correct quickly is if they're confused, we're just going to assume it's because their oxygen levels are low. So if they're confused, we're going to go ahead and give five breaths immediately before we start treating them. All right. So if this person comes out, they're altered, they're maybe unresponsive or something. The first thing we're going to do is five breaths because we don't want to wait to try to get oxygen to their brain. If the people are unresponsive, we're going to also start with five breaths, right? So we didn't even check a pulse yet. If the person comes out confused or unresponsive, you give them five breaths as soon as you feasibly can, right? Ideally, we're going to get them out of the water and get them onto a good spot on the shore, but we'll go over that later. You just, as soon as you feasibly can give them breaths, you will. So if that might be in your boat, that might be in the eddy, that might be on a rock, right? We can't necessarily start chest compressions everywhere like that. We can't do chest compressions in the water. We can't do chest compressions necessarily on some cobbles. You know, we might if there's enough room, but then we probably can't do chest compressions like on a raft, but unless there's a, you know, a sideboard or a table or something like that. But we can give breaths wherever we are, whenever we are, as soon as we know that someone is not acting normally or they are have altered mental status. If once they check, once we get our first five breaths, we will check for a pulse. And if there's no pulse, we will begin normal CPR with 30 compressions, two breaths, 30 compressions, two breaths. Okay. So we're going to show you a couple of videos now that are going to be fairly graphic. But again, this is where I want you to see what this really looks like. Okay. This is an example of someone who was pulled out of the ocean at the beach. Okay. And what's unfortunately happened here is these bystanders who are really meaning well, they're trying to help this guy. Their understanding of drowning is that the problem is that his lungs are full of water. Okay. And we see this all the time. So they're doing everything they can to try to get this water out of his lungs. And you see that there's lots of foam coming out. Unfortunately, what he's not getting now is oxygen. If you pull someone out of the river and their mouth is full of foam, I want you to ventilate right through that foam. Okay. As you've now kind of understand, that foam is basically someone turned on a spigot that's never ending. That foam is just going to keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. I want you to just ventilate right through it. If there's chunks of vomit, if there's foreign material and stuff, you can use your finger to just quickly sweep out their mouth. But that foam in the water, just keep ventilating right through it. Okay. What about CPR? So this isn't a full CPR class, but the big things I want you to take home about CPR is once you give that first five rescue breaths and then you start CPR, I want you to press hard, right? So we want to get full depth of our chest compressions. I want you to press fast, but not too fast, right? You can go so fast that you're just, you know, the heart doesn't have any time to fill. You want to press fast enough. It's about 100 to 120 times per minute, but make sure that you have enough time to the chest completely recoil. Okay, because the pump has to fill. I want you to minimize interruptions. So less than 10 seconds. So that requires coordination. And ideally, this is something that as guides, you would practice doing together, right? So you could do drills on this. So if you're going to be putting on the AD, if you're going to be rolling them to take their life jacket off and stuff, try to do that with a plan before you start so you can interrupt the compressions for as little as possible. And then it's going to be a ratio of 30 compressions, two breaths, okay? This next clip is of an actual drowning resuscitation from a TV show that was a number of years ago called Bondi Rescue from Bondi Beach. And it's a great video that's going to show you here. These lifeguards here have rescued this person from the surf, and they are see that they're minimizing chest compressions. They're only stopping for long enough to get the pads on. They're putting the defibrillator pads on around him, okay? And they're pressing hard. They're letting the chest fully recoil. And they are have using two people to ventilate the patient in a ratio of 30 to 2. You can see that the foam coming out of his mouth, the water there. The defibrillator is analyzing right now. You can't touch them while that's doing it because it'll mess up their the algorithm while it's trying to shock. Now, there was no shock advised, but you notice now he started breathing on his own again, okay? So that's what good team-focused CPR looks like. So it's a team working together to try to provide really good CPR, okay? Now, what about the rescue breaths, okay? So clearly, to be able to do that, right, you can't do that in an eddy with a patient still in the water, right? There's no way you could do that. It'd be very hard to do this in a paddle raft, right? But the most important thing is getting that oxygen to them and doing those breaths. And so this is a really extreme example of it. But what I want you to see here is this. This is a Evan Geiselman, a professional surfer here. He very much like what it would be like to get worked in a huge hydraulic. He gets, you know, pushed underwater. He is unconscious. He is not breathing. And one of the other surfers is able to rescue him. And he's obviously a very good swimmer, has a little bit of flotation with him here, and is able to give him some rescue breaths while he's still here in the water. This is very hard to do, but it's significantly easier if someone has flotation. And so remember that this guy right now, Evan, the surfer here, he's not suffering from a lack of dry land. He's suffering from a lack of oxygen. So he's able to get breaths in the water. Now, are you going to be able to do this in the middle of a swim in a rapid? Like, no, not at all. But think about the times that if you might be with somebody in an eddy and you might need help getting him up onto the rocks, you know, you can't start CPR there, but you could certainly give him some rescue breaths while you're waiting for someone else to come help, right? You can do this in the boat while you're trying to get to an eddy, right? So don't wait to give those breaths till you're the optimal place for CPR. You can start those right away, okay? Next thing, get a good mask, okay? A lot of us are carrying these pocket masks that are fantastic that we can keep right in the pocket of our life jacket, have it with us all the time. They are basically just a sheet of plastic. I know Zach has them on his website. I give them out at all my classes and stuff. And they're a great first start, but there's some really awesome masks that you can get out here that are really easy to use. This one's called the SealRite. I love it. It's all plastic. It's designed for lifeguards. It's round. It's really easy to seal on their face. All the parts, you know, will work if they get wet. It's fantastic. But there's also pocket BVMs, like a whole BVM you could pull out of your first aid kit. But the key thing here is knowing how to use it. So practice, go get some training using a mannequin so you can know how to properly seal this thing to someone's mask and give the breaths effectively. When doing mouth to mouth with a barrier or without, you only want to blow in hard enough to get their chest to rise. All right. It's very easy for us to overdo it, to bag either too hard, to give too much volume, or to do it too fast. So just over about 1 second, give a nice steady breath out enough to just watch their chest rise and then fall back down. If you do it very hard, too fast, it mostly goes into their stomach and that will just lead to more vomiting and be not effective. And too much pressure into their lung can actually injure them further. But the biggest thing to remember is just enough for their chest to rise. Okay. So we unfortunately have been faced with a situation. We'd have a drowning. Okay. We're at the pool in the city. How long are we going to keep doing CPR? Well, we're just going to keep doing CPR until EMS arrives. But if we're somewhere out in the wilderness, if we are, you know, even an hour or so from help, how long are we going to keep doing CPR on a drowning patient? Well, this is a big question, right? So there's like my guidelines based answer, and then there's also kind of the sort of soft skills part of this, right? So number one is like, how long are we going to keep making this a rescue versus transitioning to a body recovery? So if someone's entrapped, their head's down, we know they don't have an air pocket, they're underwater, guidelines that we published would recommend that you could transition to recovery after 30 minutes of rescue of the person underwater with no air pocket, with no airway in warm water, that'd be 43 degrees or warmer. And because we know really after 30 minutes in water, that temperature, there's really no chance of any meaningful survival. You can extend that up to 90 minutes in cold water, but I would be really hesitant to do this in most boating situations where people are wearing thermal protection or were like maxed out heart rate stuff when they went into this, because again, we're talking about brain injury that happens quickly within minutes. And the people just can't cool down fast enough in all that dry wear and wetsuits and stuff to have meaningful hypothermia that would protect their brain from injury quickly enough in that thing. So, and why that matters is because, you know, the last thing you want is for someone to be doing some really risky rescue and end up having further injuries or fatalities, you know, beyond the time frame when they could have possibly even saved this person, right? So then you end up with, you know, two fatalities in a situation when you really shouldn't have even been risking it anymore, right? So our best chance that if we want to make a high risk move, if we feel like it's the thing to do, you want to do it quickly, because as those minutes tick by, the chances of survival go down significantly. Regardless, once you start CPR, you can stop after 30 minutes, because after 30 minutes of CPR in people who have a generally normal body temperature, there's really no chance of survival, at least for drowning patients. What about using AEDs? They're becoming more common on the river. A lot of outfitters are carrying them, and it's fantastic, right? They are absolutely lifesavers. They save people's lives when they have heart attacks and have an irregular heart rhythm that causes them to collapse, which happens on river trips, right? So you can take a bad swim. One of your guests is like maxed out adrenaline, has a bad swim, and maybe they had some unstable heart disease that they didn't know about, and then they have a heart attack out there, right? So that AED will absolutely save their life in that case. Unfortunately for drowning patients, it does not usually, just the way drowning happens through lack of oxygen, it's usually not a shockable rhythm, but sometimes it is, all right? So I 100% advocate using AEDs and having them. They are definite lifesavers. It may not be that helpful in drowning patients, but it's definitely not harmful. And there's a lot of concern about using them in wet environments, but you don't need to worry about that, right? So that the electrodes will not like electrify the whole area around them. It just sends a point-to-point current from positive to negative on the two pads, okay? And you don't have to worry about being like on wet rocks near them or anything. It's not going to shock you. Okay, you just have to dry them enough to be able to get the pads to stick and you're good to go. Okay, what about worrying about spine injuries? Well, in any of those algorithms, A, B, C, airway comes first no matter what. And we're also now think that those hard cervical collars we've been using for years have been kind of overstated, may not actually have any evidence that they help at all. And we know that actual incidence of spine injury is between 0.5 to 5%, so very unlikely. And typically associated with like cliff diving and stuff in our drowning patients, and our guidelines discourage using hard collars at all. And definitely, 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 even if your protocols or things have you using these still, which many still do, do not delay extricating someone from the water or giving them rescue breaths to put on collars, right? So this is, you're doing your algorithm out of order. Airway and breathing come first no matter what, okay? Kind of wrapping it up here, hopefully you've rescued this person before they had they went far down that process, right? So we know that in cardiopulmonary arrest, okay, so that means that person is drowned and they have no pulse because it went on long enough that the oxygen got so low that their heart stopped. They have 93% of those people will die no matter what we do, okay? But remember, that's not 100. So you should definitely do everything you can for these people. Some of them do great, right? They may have no morbidity. They may be fine. They may have end up with no brain injury if you intervene quickly. Less than half of people that just are not breathing die. So that's great, right? So that means that if you give those rescue breaths, people start breathing again on their own, you've got a greater than 50% chance that person's going to make it. But the question then comes to, what about some of your guests that may have had a swim and they had a cough, but they aren't foaming and they're coughing a little bit? What do we need to do as far as evacuation and mortality? And maybe we're on a multi-day trip or something. What's our threshold to evacuate people? Well, it's really hard to give you guidelines for that, but I think it's interesting to just think about these grades of drowning here. It's like the 1 through 3 is really the interesting thing. So we see that really, if you don't have foam and your lungs sound clear, as long as these people stay stable, they're probably fine. They have, if that's truly is what's going on, they have a 0% mortality. So we've all seen this before, right? So you have bad swim, you might cough for 15 minutes or so, but then you're okay. You may cough occasionally, but you rapidly get better and you're fine, right? So that was technically drowning, but it's just very, very mild. As soon as you start seeing people have foam in their mouth and their lungs sound abnormal, the mortality is no longer zero, right? So these are people you need to really be thinking about evacuating. It's still very low percentage if they just have some crackles and small foam, but it gets up to 5% and then much higher as they start to have abnormal blood pressure, which we can tell, kind of estimate by knowing whether their pulse is. And lastly, for you guys, cold water. So cold water is an amplifying thing for us with drowning. So what happens here is we immerse ourselves in cold water is we have this cold shock that happens when our skin is rapidly cooled. We have this involuntary gasp, right? So it's faster that our skin cools, the stronger this cold water shock phenomenon happens. So it can start at even 73 degree Fahrenheit water. It starts this involuntary gasp, hyperventilating, and they rapidly cool and our blood vessels all start constricting, right? This is something that we can all relate to, right? That getting dunked in that cold water. After 5 minutes-ish of this in kind of the experimental models, which was like people unclothed people in water done many years ago, people will start to have a swimming failure. As you start taking a long swim, your nerves get cold, you lose your dexterity, you might faint, okay? And then after some amount of time, which depends on how well insulated you are, you'll start to get hypothermic, right? Well, so you actually, in moving water, it can happen faster. If you're not wearing appropriate thermal gear, it can happen faster, right? So eventually then you'll become hypothermic. But that thing is too, that cold shock is that gasping, because what happens if you get immersed in cold water and then you gasp and you hyperventilate while you're trying to control your breathing to swim through big white water? Well, that can really just set that drowning process into high gear by causing aspiration of lots of water right off the get-go. So, you know, how do we mitigate this? We want to slow the rate of cooling of our skin down by wearing warm gear, right? So wetsuits, dry suits, splash gear, making sure that we're wearing the right gear. Having enough flotation, right? That helps us with swimming failure. That helps keeps our airway out of the water and we get tired, right? We don't have to use as much effort to swim if we've got more flotation. We know that eventually our fine motor skills are going to diminish. So we want to get people out of the water quickly, right? And, you know, a lot of ropes in the water or things where people have to use their fine motor skills. If they've been in the water for a while, they may not be able to handle those ropes, right? Because their nerves are so cold that they can't use their fingers. And then lastly, you know, wearing the right warm gear is what's going to keep us from getting hypothermic in the first place. So that's super important. So lastly, so I'll just give you guys the last take-home points here. So remember, drowning is a process, right? It's a brain problem. That process we want to interrupt before we have irreversible damage to our brain. And we interrupt that by giving rescue breaths and rescuing people, okay? Don't wait. Give them as soon as you can, even if they're not in the perfect place to start CPR. All you have to do is be able to have their head out of the water and be able to give them rescue breaths, okay? If you see foam, breathe right through it. And we can really cut down on lots of these incidents in the boating community if we really have everyone wearing appropriate life jackets and minimizing alcohol use on the river. Alcohol substance use is one of the big preventable factors we see in a lot of these incidents. So with that, I'd love to take some questions about all this.
Awesome. Chris, thank you. So good. If people have questions, put them in the comments and I'll get to them. I have questions. I watched every year before the season, I watched the last video we did and that you did, just to refresh myself. And this year I've been doing little mini scenarios with our guides. And through them, I've developed questions, things I'm not sure about. Or the guides ask me things. I'm not an expert. So I just do my best to like answer them. So I have a lot of questions for you. Yeah. Some of the stuff you covered there, but I'm going to ask it again just because I really want to clarify it. So the first one is if – you use the term in there, confused.
Yeah.
Is confused. Can somebody be breathing and confused?
Yeah. So like, you're talking like someone, you pull someone out of the river and they're not acting right. You know? So in that kind of situation, you mean?
So you like, do you just give them 5 rescue breaths? Like they're breathing, but I pull somebody out of the water. They're confused. Do I just go in on rescue breaths?
That would be, it's like a super judgment call. Like if someone's breathing okay, you know, and they look like they're breathing fine. No, but like if they're truly like, you know, they're like, oh, where am I? They're able to talk and stuff. I probably wouldn't. If they're like so altered, they're like moaning, they're not making appropriate words. They're like not opening their eyes unless you like do something painful to them. That would be the kind of thing where I'd start giving them rescue breaths. If they're just sort of, I guess that would be a really good clarification. So if someone's just like, oh, what happened? I'm sort of confused. That's probably someone that you would need to do rescue breaths on. I'm thinking more like somebody that comes out and they're like moaning or like, or not able to open their eyes, anything like that, but still
breathing. But they are breathing.
Yes. Even if they're still breathing.
So you would get, even though they're breathing, you think they need more oxygen in that.
Yes.
Group.
Yeah.
Because their heart's not pumping or just they're not.
That's so the reason we can't. So if we were able to measure their oxygen level, we would be able to say, oh, well, maybe the reason they're confused, and we'd say their oxygen level should be like 95% or higher. It might be 70%, 60% because they're down there. And so you want to just give them that extra boost, right? Give them more oxygen back faster. And so the extra pressure that we're giving by giving that breath forcefully in there actually can help them oxygenate a little bit better.
So the confusion is almost like a symptom of the low oxygen levels.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So the confusion is a symptom of low oxygen, and we have no way to test. There's dozens of things that could be causing their confusion.
Yeah.
But the most pressing thing that we can just rule out is just give them rescue breaths and maybe they'll get better. Right. And if they don't, you didn't hurt them, right? So that's the,
so it doesn't hurt to give rescue breaths.
Like absolutely not. Right. You can give them rescue breaths. Worst thing they can do is push you away and say, stop, don't do that. And you're like, okay, well, I guess you don't need them. So, right. It's same thing as starting chest compressions, right? If you start chest compressions and someone wakes up and pushes you away, great. You know, you didn't hurt them. You know, you didn't hesitate.
I mean, chest compressions, you can break the ribs, right?
You could. In most healthy people, you don't usually. We see people all the time that come in. We, you know, unfortunately, one of the biggest things we see is opiate overdoses. They come into the ER and get CPR from bystanders. And most of them are actually fine. You know, they get bystander CPR. A family member or something will do chest compressions and they're fine. You know, they have no broken ribs. They have anything. But, you know, also, you know, a broken rib versus dead. I'll take the broken rib every day, you know? And so that's I would have not hesitate to either try rescue breaths or start chest compressions if unsure. And the reason for that is that we know from like the big research and like out of hospital cardiac arrest, that for every minute that goes by, that someone doesn't get chest compressions in cardiac arrest, their chance of survival goes down by 10%. So for every minute that goes by. So we can't necessarily extrapolate that exactly to drowning, but like, it really kind of proves the point. Like, so that's why we say, just try, just start it. If they,
but you're only going to do chest compressions if there's no pulse.
If there's no pulse. That's right.
Yeah. Like if somebody has a pulse, you're not going to do chest compressions.
Exactly. So if they,
you're saying like, I've been taught they're not breathing, then you breathe to them.
Yeah.
You're saying, oh, well, if they're confused, maybe you can start breathing early.
Yes.
Chest compressions, you're definitely not going to do it unless there's no pulse.
Right. So that would be, and if there's no pulse, or if you're like, I'm not sure, right? Because that will happen very frequently. If you're jacked up on adrenaline, if you
can't find the pulse.
Yeah. You can't find the pulse. If you're not sure, you're like, I don't know, maybe there's a pulse, just start chest compressions, you know, just start them. Their pulse may be there. It might be so weak that you can't feel it, but you're not going to hurt them. You're probably going to help them, right? By doing that, you're giving their heart a little extra help. You're giving them some oxygen. You're helping circulate stuff, their blood around better. That will definitely help.
Okay. And if they have a pulse, you're going to give them 5 rescue breaths and then continue to give 1 breath every 6 seconds.
That's correct. Yeah.
So then one for a long time.
Yeah. Until they are better. Right. So until they seem to be breathing on their own, like, so we saw in that video from the beach with the lifeguards, right, that they did chest compressions on that guy. They went to the AED to shock. No shock was advised, but then they went to check his pulse afterwards. He was breathing. So he was starting to breathe on his own, right? So that he got, you know, that was 2 or 3, maybe 2 minutes of CPR, and they got enough oxygen back that his heart started again. And he started breathing on his own. They helped him breathe for a little bit, but probably started breathing on his own after, you know, a few more minutes.
And so the heart will start again because of oxygen.
That's correct.
So like the brain gets oxygen that it needs, and then it sends a signal to the heart that says, hey, start pumping again.
The heart
might stop, but if you get chest compressions, if you get breaths, it might get oxygen in the system that gets the brain going, which might get the heart going on its own.
Yeah. So the heart, it's kind of cool that it actually doesn't need any inputs from the brain to beat. It just does it, right? So it just does it by itself. So as long as it has enough fuel to run, it'll completely on its own beat. So, but it needs oxygen too. So
got it. Yeah.
The brain will get injured first, right? So the heart can tolerate being without oxygen for longer. So kind of what you'd expect kind of that process is that you'd get the oxygen back enough, right? Their heart would start beating again on its own. it may take a while for someone to wake back up after that. Because your brain does take a while to kind of reboot after things like that. If you kind of imagine like your computer has to reboot, your brain has to kind of reboot. Sort of like if someone has a seizure or some other things, it just there's some like rebooting time afterwards.
Okay. So the scenario we've been doing is like somebody's drowning in the river. We pull them into a raft. We go right into five breaths, but you can't really do CPR on a raft.
Yeah.
You wouldn't even try. You'll just like, if there's no pulse, you're like, we have to get them to shore.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you're in like a boat that you could like conceivably do, if you've got a box or, you know, your table on the front or something, you might be able to, but kind of at that point, it's probably gonna be pretty crappy CPR. You might have to take their life jacket off on the boat while you're still in the water. Like you might lose them. My thought is like you get those breaths in, but then be just hauling ass to shore and like get that boat. Yeah. Like get that boat somewhere you can actually really do work, you know? Okay. Like,
and then we've been practicing with this whole thing with the life jacket on.
Yeah.
It's an unzip one. So we've been pulling it off the top, but they're on it on their back sometimes. Cause it takes time. Do you think we should like really prioritize getting the back of the PFD off too?
I mean, I've seen one of the videos that you had from it. It was like super awesome. I love that sort of concept of like a pit crew approach to doing it, which is like, that's how we're training our paramedics and stuff to do just all CPR is like in this pit crew approach. Yeah. I think that's an awesome strategy. Like get it up, just get chest compression started. And then once you've got enough people there and stuff, make a coordinated effort to, you know, roll them, get the whole thing out and back. When you can do it without with like minimizing chest compressions, right?
So really prioritize. You have to get the top off. You can't do CPR with the front of the PFD. So if it's an over the head one, you have to get it off.
Yeah.
But if you're rushed, unzip it, get it out, start doing compressions, and then try to prioritize getting it off because it's a process. You have arms in the way. It's not an easy thing.
So like my thought process, you're probably losing a little bit of effectiveness of the CPR, like maybe a little bit, but what you're definitely like going through, particularly if you don't have much help there with you, the process of actually getting it off someone's arm is going to take a really long time, like way more than 10 seconds, you know? Yeah. So I think that's a really good strategy is to like get it off, start chest compressions. Then once you've got enough help, be like, okay, we're going to pause. We're going to pulse check and we're going to get the life jacket off at this time. And then switch to a new chest compressor. Like, so you could just do that like all at once in one move. So you just minimize the interruptions. It's very easy. We see it all the time that people will want to do something. And the next thing you know, like 45 seconds has gone by with no chest compressions. Cause you're trying to like work on something or get something off.
Yeah. Doing these exercises, it's just a reminder. There's tricky parts. Like there's things that take time that it's good for practicing for sure.
Yeah. I know a lot of people have kind of emphasized like just cut, you know, if someone's got an over the head life jacket, like try to cut it off. But man, when we've tried that and things, it probably takes longer to cut it off than it would to just pull it over their head, like loosen the straps and pull it over their head. It's worth trying. You know, if you got some old life jackets and stuff, we've done it before. And if you have trauma shears, it's actually fairly easy, but with like a river knife, like it's kind of hard to cut.
Depends on the knife. I mean, I can just tell you for a fact, there's some pretty bad knives out there. but if you have like the Gerber Easy out, this one would probably do a decent job.
Yeah. I've got that salt saver. It would probably slice right through it. No problem.
Probably do it too. But if you have some just like peanut butter knife, maybe not.
Yeah, good luck. You should probably just pull it over their head.
So the other thing I've been telling the crew is that I like the distinction between the foam and not foam as an evac, right? Yeah. If they don't have foam, you don't have to evac. Like you can, but you can wash them for 4 hours and just see if they're stable. Like specifically, what are we looking for in terms of stable?
So like the biggest thing that I would say, so, you know, the two things that you want to pay attention to, one is how do they feel? So like, do they feel short of breath? They're like, I'm having trouble breathing. Like I feel like I'm having trouble breathing. So if in particular, you don't expect your guides and stuff to be, you know, to be executing like really high level decision-making on right, as far as medical something, it's just not, you don't need to. Like, so if they feel like they're getting worse, if they're like, I feel like I'm short of breath, I take that very seriously, right? The second thing is if you look at their basic vital signs, if their respiratory rate is going up, that's usually one of the earliest signs that someone's having more trouble breathing. They will start breathing faster. And that's something that is objective. Like you can just write the number down. You count it and write the number down. And if it's going up,
Big respiratory rate up. So we're looking for trouble breathing and respiratory rate increasing.
Yeah, that's those two things. And the so if they feel like they're having more trouble breathing, and if their respiratory rate is going up, those two. There's a lot of other things too, but I think those are two things that would be easy and reliable.
Like, we need things that are easy. We're not doctors. We just need and if we're in doubt, evacuate.
But if you just got, and also like, as river guys, you guys have a really good sense of like something seems wrong with somebody. They don't seem right. Like if something seems off, like don't hesitate to evacuate someone. You don't want to be agonizing over it. I mean, I do know, and it's a big deal, and people pay a lot of money, it's going a long time to be on these trips and stuff. And they don't want to go, but like, you know, it's the last thing you want is to be, you know, storm comes in, it's middle of the night, you can't get someone out, you're in a camp where there's no way to get them out, and then now they're getting worse, it's 3 a.m. You know, like that's what you don't want.
Okay, the last question I think I have, we've been playing with that mini BVM, the one that packs small.
Yeah.
It's worth practicing with it. We're learning. Like, you can't just have one and just figure it out in the field. You need to practice with that thing.
Yeah. They're awesome, but I think it's even harder to put them back in their container. Like
that's the funny thing is I just tell the guys, give it to me. I'll do it. I've done it a bunch of times. Like, it's hard to get it back. So we have a training one that we just always pulling it out. This, you know, get kind of beat up a little bit, but it does require practice. Like if you've never used it, you're not going to just use it in the, like, to save somebody.
No.
And I also really like the SEALRITE. You told me about that SEALRITE mask. Yeah. I carry it in my kit. Can you attach the BVM to the SEALRITE?
Yes. Absolutely. So it's those adapter, like the mask sizes are universal. So like every single thing that goes onto a bag valve mask is the same size. Like, so the SEALRITE will fit it. Like the tubes we put in people's mouths on the ventilator stuff, those fit, like everything is exactly the same size.
Okay. Because it's when we looked at, I told them, I said, hey, if the bag valve mask isn't working, the mask that comes with the bag valve mask is an option to just blow into, but it's not a one-way valve.
Yeah.
So
the SEALRITE the SEALRITE mask, they have everything's made of plastic in it. So like there's no paper diaphragm to get messed up when it gets wet and stuff.
And the SEALRITE is a little squishy on purpose, right? Like that's kind of the beauty of it, is it's not a hard mask. It's purposely squishy so it can fit on somebody's face really nicely.
Yeah. And the other thing that's super nice about it is it's round. So you don't have to orient it in any particular direction. Yeah. You can put it on any way and it will work just as well.
Oh, that's interesting. Cause when we were messing with the BVM, we're always just trying to like figure out like how to hold it down the best. And it's tricky to get on there.
I think the SEALRITE is like, as easy as it gets for like in a high stress situation. Cause it was, you know, designed for like for lifeguards in the water. So who are going to be like one hand trying to swim, trying to give a breath. And, you know, it's in fact, I think it's just a better design. It just works better.
Yeah. It's bigger. It takes more space. So that, you know, I think in boating space is always a premium.
Yep. It's a good thing for your kit. It's like not something you're going to have in your PFD, but like, it's, you know, it's great to have in your kit.
Yeah. I mean, it is. I agree. But kits get big really quick. You know, all of a sudden somebody's like, oh, you also should bring this fancy first aid thing. And like every time I do something related to first aid with our guides, I get like 5 suggestions and our kit can get very big, very quick.
Next thing you know, you've got a 60 liter first aid kit.
But of course, like, you know, drowning, we're around water. We're a water sport. Drowning is a big deal. So we added the mini BVMs, which take up space, which I believe in.
Yeah,
but I think we're now going to add those SEALRITE to our kits too, because they're just that good.
Yeah, it's like, so I've just got like a little watershed that I just always have with me, like whenever I'm boating or guiding or anything. And like, I have one of those two in there all the time. I'll just have one of the two, but like, I think it's super, super nice.
In my personal kit, like same thing, a little watershed. I have that SEALRITE. Once you told me about it, I got it and I put it in there.
Yeah. It's sweet. There's only a couple places that you can get them from.
Hard to find.
They're not particularly expensive either, though, which is nice. Yeah.
It was hard to track down.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's all I have for questions. Chris, man, thanks for being here. Thanks for doing this again. I feel lucky because I just get to ask you questions and they get dialed in. So thanks for doing it. And any last thoughts or anything you want to share that you're doing coming up?
No, absolutely. Just psyched to be here. And if you guys want or look for any more, if you really want to nerd out and get deeper into all this stuff, we published some guidelines last year. You can Google for the Wilderness Medical Society practice guidelines for treatment and prevention of drowning. We published those last summer, and it's kind of the you know, the go-to if you want to get into the science and all the recommendation stuff between all that. It's not light reading, but it's, if you really want to nerd out, it's a great document. Look at it. It's free on the internet. You can just search for it.
Chris, and, if you send me the link, I'll put it in the notes below, in the notes.
Perfect. Yeah.
I'll send on the YouTube thing with this. So just send it to me and I'll have it. Cool. Well, that's it. Stay on for a minute. I'm going to end the stream, but stay on because I want to check in with you before we go.
Okay.